It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
And that's why, even though I did need a stunt person for episode 134, we could not afford to also get you one.
Well, I like doing my own stunts.
Does it still click when you move that joint?
Like I said, I like doing my own stunts. I know what the risk is. I knew what I was doing. And yes, it does, but that's fine. I knew that was going to be a problem. So. All
right. I just want to explain potential that to problem. You.
That's just, you know, when you're the kind of when you're the kind of actor that I am.
Yeah, very, very, very method.
Yeah.
Really obsessed with the visuals, which I find interesting given we're audio only, but you're really, the number of times we've done stuff and I'm like, let's just do it this way, like, no, it's going to look so much cooler.
Well, I just find that it enhances every aspect of the performance. But when you commit like that, you just, you know what might happen and you just accept it. So even if you could have found a stunt double, I probably would have said, nope, I'm going to do my own stunts.
I defer to your commitment. I have spoken many times with my wife and with your wife about you being committed for many times over the years.
Yes.
Hello. We held that bit together pretty well. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast. The only podcast in the world recorded from the inside of a very small songbird in a cage made out of bamboo in a garden far, far away from where we are recording this podcast. I'm Tony.
And I'm William. And this is episode 285.
Yeah, you're still not coming in. I don't know. We didn't get any feedback, so to speak, last time on your volume level. So I think, which might explain why we have such loyal listeners. I think our listeners have a really low bar for acceptance. I think many times I hear that, oh, I can understand all the words. And I'm like, okay, is that all it takes? Because I feel like even that's a stretch for me, you know. But yeah. I do my best. We might have forgotten last week to explain the podcast, so maybe I should explain it now. Here's how this thing works. We have a hat. It is magical in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. People, pretty much the folks that are listening to this, write into that email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with little notes, comments, topics, questions, things like that. The hat, all on its own, magically transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written on them that manifest physically within the hat itself. It's every word that starts with E has been used up already. Servants draw those note cards out of the hat at random, read them on the air, talk about them till we're bored, do that for about an hour. That is the show. I want you to get a good look here at these little fuzzy white balls, because you'll never see him the same again. Monday, he's going in to get them fixed.
Okay, then.
We are so excited.
Why is that?
Because he's such a little menace, and supposedly he should calm down some from it. I mean, some of that is he needs to grow up, too, but certain hormonal things will happen then, so.
I see.
He's crazy. All right, so how has your week been?
It's been good. Although my writing has been very frustrated, so that makes me very encouraged to hear about your writing going so well. Because I'm always encouraged by someone else's success.
I was going to say, most people go the other direction. It's very encouraging to hear that you're having the same trouble I do. Makes me feel less alone, but in your case, it's good to know you're succeeding, because somebody's got to.
Well, it gives me hope. I mean, you know what I'm saying.
I'm stealing all your success.
Well, it's not this limited resource out there, and you're getting it, and I'm not. It's more of a...
I had the most huge ego boost for my writing today.
Oh.
So every 2 weeks at work, we get paid. And on the off week, the week we don't get paid, you have to submit a timesheet with your hours and like what it is billed to and stuff like that. And I inherited a system wherein people get reminded of that it's happening. So like a couple days before, an email automatically would go out from my email that said, don't forget to turn in your timesheet by the end of Friday. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so years go by. We switch systems. I no longer can set up an automated thing, so I just actually do it myself. I send out emails. And it's me. So over the years, they've kind of altered. And they've become more little jokes, little stories, little strange metaphors for timesheets instead. And they're very popular. There are people who have left the area that I do this around and have asked to please still be on the emails. Just because, I mean, they still have to submit timesheets wherever they are. But and other people, somebody new shows up and they're like, oh, I've told them about this, you have to get it. So there are a couple of people, it's not so popular, and they usually write me and they say, take me off the list, and I say, okay. But what amazes me is the level that I've used this to disseminate other information too, and at no point was I ever authorized to do this. But I send these very, very silly emails to like hundreds of people, and nobody's ever come back at me, so it's kind of funny. But anyway, so today, I really went out. I wrote a little dialogue story where she's like, I want you to do me a favor. And I said, anything, you name it. She's like, I want you to turn in your timesheets on time by Friday. And I said, I already do that. And she's like, I didn't finish yet. Let me finish. And this whole big thing. And then she gets in her spaceship and flies away. And people loved it.
No.
I get compliments sometimes, but this one, like somebody said, it was probably my best ever. Several people are like, how long did it take you to come up with? And I'm like, literally as I was typing, I just pulled it out of my butt. And so I'm like, if the level of quality required for publishing books is anywhere near the level of quality required for notifying people about timesheets, I'm going to be such a successful author. And if it's not, I might be able to start a career as a professional timesheet reminder. Other people have suggested some sort of coffee table book. I'm considering doing a serial where, like, the next one is a story that ends on a cliffhanger and then, like, two, you know,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
That's
but we'll
idea.
See. I'm sorry, but we're back to your week. Your writing has suffered because of my success.
No. What? Okay. By the way, have you, when sweet corn season comes around, do you eat a lot of sweet corn? Or?
Not much. I've never cared. I will admit, biting into a good cob of sweet corn with a lot of butter on it, happy. But it, like, if I went through a summer and didn't eat any sweet corn, I'd be like, oh, okay. Huh. But Trish is still into it, so Trish frequently buys them, and I don't ever turn it down when people have them. And sometimes they'll even buy enough with the neighbors, and so they'll freeze some of it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I haven't had a lot this year, and the last one I had, I was at Chili's for the first time in ages, and that is some shit corn on the cob there. So.
Well, you know, it starts, sweet corn season here's been going on for a while, late July. It'll go through a little bit in September, probably. Sometimes it doesn't go quite that long. But it's kind of a funny thing in Iowa, sweet corn season, because a lot of people think of Iowa as a corn state, you know.
Yes.
And you see a lot of proud Iowa natives wearing these shirts. It's got a silhouette of Iowa and it says corn fed in there.
Yep, yep.
Which is, I find, rather humorous, because For one thing, sweet corn's a fairly recent thing in human history. What, the late 18th century or something?
I don't know. I just remember about the initial discovery of maize by the Western people, and it was all great, and they didn't realize they couldn't digest it.
Well, for most of human history, corn was exclusively a thing that, like a grain.
Well, except in the First Nations in the Americas, who discovered, what is it, nyctimalization or whatever, where you soak it in... I want to say, like, you soak it in something, like, bad.
Oh, yeah,
but
yeah,
then
yeah.
Then you sure. can eat it. And that's why conquistadors come over, and there's all this corn being eaten, and they're like, great, and they take it back to Europe, and it sucks.
But they also grind it and make meal and flour out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
That was one of the main ways that it was used for thousands of years, and today it's probably the main way that it's used. And it's kind of interesting that people eat corn from like cans and then frozen and whatever that doesn't taste anything like, you know, sweet corn that
you just
got out of the garden. So, but Iowa's corn economy and culture and everything about corn in Iowa has to do with like field corn.
Yep.
That also does have all corn goes through. Sweet corn and field corn both go through a certain phases in its development where the kernels will have like a clear liquid in them, and then it's a milky liquid, and then the starches take over, and it's a starch in the end. And the sweet corn process, that milky phase, is a little bit longer and it's sweeter. I mean, if you take field corn when it's in the milk phase, it's just not very good. It's just not grown for that purpose. So sweet, and Iowa doesn't produce a lot of sweet corn. We don't produce it as a commodity because a lot of people don't think about this, but farmers have to sell what they grow. So like my dad, the reason he grows corn and soybeans is because, you know, he can drive 2 miles to a grain elevator and sell it.
Yeah.
Back in the day, Iowa had like 250 canneries. That's like two to a county. And it made sense for someone to maybe grow tomatoes. Because there was a cannery you could sell it at. But now all the canneries are gone.
Well, and usually in a lot of the farms, you would do enough for yourself. So my Trisha's grandfather had the farm as corn and soy, but I mean lots and lots of corn. And the thing was, everybody who knew that the first two rows were sweet corn, and then the rest was all the rest of the acreage was field corn. And my mother-in-law likes to tell a story about migrant workers that were out there helping out and as a reward told them to do that. But they apparently didn't understand the English well enough because they saw them running around grabbing corn from the other rows. But then nobody ever said anything later. So they're like, I don't know if they thought it was good or what.
Well, if they ground it into meal.
Maybe they made masa. Who knows?
It was perfectly fine. But and today, there are a lot of vegetable and fruit growers in Iowa, but it's all for local markets.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Hardly anybody sells to... in a commodity market because there's no place to sell it. And I mean, you can't even grow oats really anymore because a lot of grain elevators don't have cleaners. You know, you've got to clean oats. You've got to get the husks and clean it off or whatever. So anyway,
mares eat oats.
It
and does eat oats.
I often observe that little Iowans lambs. are they're very proud of raising corn, and they're very proud of corn in the state. We're a top corn producer and everything. But sweet corn seems to be like they treat sweet corn as if there's some kind of connection between it.
Yes, they do.
And the corn that they grow.
Yes, they do.
Even
which brings me to the point that I've been holding back because I was letting you say your thing tied in this. I come from Oregon. Oregon has quite a lot of agriculture. A lot of people don't seem to realize this.
Oh, yeah, sure they do.
A great deal of it is fruit, but, I mean, we get grains and stuff there, too. We also have sweet corn, and it's very good.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it is.
And, in fact, all things considered, my full experiences, of which there have been dozens of both now, I think I like Oregon sweet corn better than Iowa sweet corn. And the number of Iowans... not even just, but like people from Illinois and stuff too, who not only disagree with me having never had Oregon sweet corn, but talk as if I'm an idiot, that it's silly to even say that because this is where the corn is grown.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's, yeah, because it's corn. Well, and I'm like, I'm not saying we have as much as you. It's sweet corn. It's not.
The fact is, you might have more. I mean, I don't know any statistic that says Iowa. First of all, since Iowa doesn't produce it commercially, there's plenty of states who grow more sweet corn than Iowa does. But even if you just look at states who grow it in gardens, there's no statistic that says that Iowa grows more garden sweet corn than other, like than New Jersey, for example. Yeah. And okay, you like Oregon sweet corn better, that's fine. But the fact of the matter is, it's probably all the same. Probably all planted with the same seeds. I mean, there's going to be differences from the
terroir.
Well, the soil.
Like with wine.
Well, there's going to be differences in the soil you plant it in and stuff, but not that a lot of people are going to be able to notice. And for a lot of people...
That's a great terroir joke that just was wasted.
And for a lot of people, it's probably just a matter of local pride or whatever, and that's fine, except you're right. A lot of people don't talk about it like that. I know objectively that this
corn
is...
When I say I like Oregon sweet corn better than Iowa sweet corn, I may have once, many years ago, offhand thought that and said it in a casual thing or whatever, and then the response I have gotten back has caused me to dig in my heels. So Oregon sweet corn kicks Iowa sweet corn's ass.
It's just interesting that there's really no connection at all between the sweet corn that's grown in gardens in Iowa and the corn that's grown in the field and the economy and culture and political and economic and everything about that corn. But Iowans think about it that way. Mm-hmm. And so sweet corn in Iowa has kind of become like a ritual and an emblem. Like there's a cultural, ritualistic aspect to it. It's not just a food. And but I mean, people don't really talk about it or think about it that way. You can just see when they're proud of Iowa sweet corn and they talk about Iowa sweet corn, it all gets sort of mixed in with the whole corn thing about Iowa. When in reality, there's pretty much no connection there whatsoever.
It's kind of like how there is a lot of... Pork is another thing that we're known for in Iowa.
Yeah, yeah.
And the vast majority of it are on these like high capacity pig farms, these big industrial pig farms.
Yes, right. Good.
However, there are people, not commercially, but people just locally, who will gather their own and butcher their own squirrels and make that into stew and other things. Really proud of that, and they seem to lump it in with the pigs.
Yeah, right.
They're like, Iowa's a pork and squirrel place. And whereas in reality, I think the squirrels in Oregon are better.
I just think it's
kind of chewy.
When I see someone wearing a corn-fed thing, I mean, there's something ironic about it, and it's a joke, but, you know, this person, you know, probably eats a lot of Iowa sweet corn for, like, four weeks out of the year.
Yeah.
And maybe they can some of it, but even then, you know, it's not going to last all very long.
Nowadays, odds are almost every American is largely corn and soy fed.
No, that's right.
We could all wear that t-shirt.
The thing is that when people talk about, when anyone says, well, Iowa helps feed the world or whatever, these are the things on your plate that might be from Iowa. Anything pork, that's a pork product. If it's beef, it could be from Iowa, but it's very likely was fed from soy and corn from Iowa,
even if
it's not
that's
from Iowa.
Yeah.
Eggs, because Iowa's a big...
Fire truck just went by. No lights or sirens. I guess there was a kid in the street, or maybe they were just honking at a kid to say hi.
Eggs, because Iowa is actually a big egg producer. A lot of people don't know that. And anything you eat that's processed, it probably has some soy product in it, like soy lecithin, or it probably has... corn syrup or some cornstarch or some corn product, and it probably came from Iowa. If you're eating a fruit or vegetable that came from a can or a bag, no, we did not. That did not come from us. Not unless you're in Iowa and you got it from a local farmer.
Might have come from Oregon.
That's true. And California.
I worked in a processing plant for that one summer. Terrible, terrible time.
But those are the things that might have come from Iowa. It's not very many things when it comes down to it, and not very many things that I eat. Most of the stuff I eat, well, I try to eat local stuff, but if it's not local, it's probably from California. Or maybe Oregon.
Eddie really likes those shoes. Are those the same shoes? Because he's actually chewing on these ones.
Oh, yeah. Same ones. But I was just thinking about that recently. Oh, and also, we've been watching a lot of Wonder Woman trailer reaction videos. Like, we can't get enough of them. And it's interesting to see. The majority of them are from people who are not Americans, I've noticed. It's a lot of them are, they're probably more men than women, but that's kind of a function of the internet, I think, and not so much a demographic thing. Although a lot of the men responding, I've probably seen more men make pro-feminist comments in their reactions and responses than women, which I find interesting. And I think that might
be more telling about who's actually going to upload their video to YouTube.
Maybe. And there was one woman who actually made a lot of anti-feminist comments in response to it. But a few women were clearly very responded with some very positive feminist stuff from it, and several men. But most people kind of, they don't say anything about the feminist aspects of it, but they're all excited about it.
Yeah. It looks good. If it's good, I'll definitely go see it, but I'm pretty sure even if it sucks, Trish is going to make me go see it. So, but it's currently my only real exception to the DC Universe.
It interests me how...
Although if they actually end up pulling off that Justice League Dark non-animated movie someday, I'll probably go see it.
Yeah, that might be interesting. It fascinates me how far-reaching these cultural icons are, I guess, is... That's the thing that probably fascinates me the most, is there's so many people from other countries, and we'll even watch them if the people don't speak English. We just want to see what their response is. And it's like, wow, how... You know, I just think of these as American icons, and when I go read them in comic books or see them in movies, I think, this is an American thing. I don't even think of it playing in other countries. Not even in Europe, not even in England or someplace. But here are these places in, you know, far-flung countries, and... people are just totally excited about it. And I don't know how to feel about it, though, because part of me is like really proud of that and inspired by it, but another part's like, but
no, see that's the thing,
a little weird.
It's
like,
cool, but it's nothing to do with Wonder Woman being Wonder Woman. It's just that anything that is iconic in the U.S. now is everywhere. And good or bad, in this case it's a cool thing, but like I remember being in the UK in the late 90s, and I was shocked and had this weird moment that there were American soap operas on every day on British television. There were also British soap operas. There were also Australian soap operas. But, I mean, in the lineup there was Bold and the Beautiful, and it's the same one. And I was like, what? Really? And even just the weird stuff at the time, the idea that The Simpsons was on and very popular in the UK was very confusing to me. I think the stuff just spreads around. But yeah, the icons are old enough. I mean, I think if you did a newer DC title, like, I bet they didn't freak out over Suicide Squad, even though the Suicide Squad trailer looked really cool to some people.
Right, but a lot of these people, like, especially, well, particularly some of the women who are doing this, they'll start to tear up and they'll like cry because they're so happy that this
now
is
that,
finally happening.
That's a very different thing, and that is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, they're inspired by it, and they're like, and they'll say things like, you know, I'm so happy that this is finally happening, I'm so grateful that you know, and seeing young girls respond in a really excited way and saying things like that,
I
know, it's pretty cool, and but it really makes you hope that it's a decent film. Because
I really do, because we've had potentials for this before.
Yeah.
And at best, they were double-edged swords. But I'm like, you know, I feel like, honestly, I feel like the Ghostbusters movie, which did not do super well commercially, and it looks like we may never get a sequel, which is too bad. But the number of people who were just like, the number of people who were female, who were like, now I can relate to this concept, which I always liked, in a way that I couldn't before.
Yeah.
Like, now I can really see myself in that.
Well, a lot
was
of...
awesome, and I think this has so much more potential than that.
I think some of the people who actually watched the trailer and reacted to it talked about Ghostbusters and said, hey, you know, if women felt empowered by that movie, they're really going to go crazy over this. What's interesting about what you just said about that is It surprised some women, I think, even. This happened with Star Wars and Rey also. It surprised some women how it made a difference for the hero to be a female. They didn't think it would. And sometimes they heard people say that and they thought, oh, it doesn't really matter. And yet it did.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing about a lot of these, probably half of these trailers, easily half of them, are people say, I didn't know anything about Wonder Woman or care until I saw Batman v Superman, and she was so awesome in that.
Yeah. She was definitely, it seems, even though the public at large seemed to like Batman v Superman more than anyone ever should have, they did seem to get one thing right, and a lot of people, their favorite bit was the Wonder Woman.
And
stuff.
So now they're really excited about this movie because of that.
Yeah.
And I got to say, so far, everything I've seen from Gal Gadot is pretty amazing. I was with those people who, when she was first cast, thought, you know, here was an opportunity for them to cast a body type that isn't very well represented among women in film. This was the perfect opportunity to do that. And they didn't.
No.
But...
Wait, are you talking about Wonder Woman or are you talking about Candy?
I'm talking about Wonder Woman.
Because the Candy thing bugs me.
Well, okay.
Because I used to have a debate with somebody who was being weirdly rose-tinted like you are, and we're like, maybe they're going to have Candy, it's going to be awesome. I'm like, they are never going to do that. That absolutely not. And now they did it and totally cheated.
Well, okay.
I'm like, fuck off. I wish you just hadn't done it.
I get what you mean. But there comes a point where you talk about these things where, you know... I think it's perfectly right for people to say, here's a representational situation that they could have taken advantage of in a different way, and they didn't, and that's unfortunate.
But they're doing a lot of other shit right now, so let's be happy with that.
There's that, but there's also, now that the person is cast, you run the risk of starting to criticize her personally.
And so then you're
coming full circle and body shaming this woman for how she looks. So there comes a point where you have to go, no, come on, let's be fair here. I mean, this isn't her fault or whatever, and maybe she can actually do this role very well. And she has done it very well.
Kyle Kinane has ruined the phrase body shaming for me. He's a feminist, he's a great guy, but he talked about when he was getting used to having a partner that would sleep in the bed with him all the time. He's like, I don't know what to do, it's very weird, it's unusual. The other night she asked me to stop farting in bed, and I told her to stop body shaming me. I'm not sure I'm using that term right.
No, not
quite. But now anytime I hear it, I think of that.
But she's doing she looks like...
It seems great, yeah.
Well, you know, one thing I like is in Batman v Superman, there's this moment where Wonder Woman is sort of knocked down by Doomsday. And before she gets up, she kind of smiles. And then she gets up and starts fighting again. And apparently... that wasn't something Zack Snyder told her to do. She just sort of did that, and he liked it. And I thought, that to me is very cool. She's really kind of gotten into the head of this character and made it her own.
Well, and she's in interviews talked about it. Like, she's saying great stuff, but the thing she said several times that I'm really happy she gets is, how panicked she is, because she's like, this is really important. And I'm like, I love that you get that.
Yeah, well... You know, I've heard people say things like, you know, why do people get so invested and so excited about these stories? It doesn't make any sense. And look, I don't know why people don't understand this, but stories are an essential part of human life every bit as much as food, clothing, and shelter. And that's just a fact. And stories do impact people's lives. You know, Linda Carter, to this day, has people coming up to her telling her things like, you know, your portrayal of Wonder Woman saved my life. I mean, those are real stories.
Oh, yeah, and to say nothing of Nichelle Nichols.
Sure, people, you can say all you want about how stupid or crazy that is, but you can't deny the fact that a life was saved there, and that's a big deal, and that's important. And so these things can really change people's lives, shape people's lives, and I don't think it's unreasonable or silly for people to hope that they're going to have that kind of impact on the world. And I like you. I'm glad that she understands the potential of this character in this film. And, you know, my wife and I, our attitude about it is, we just want this one to be good. If they make two or three more and they're terrible, that's fine.
That's how sequels are.
Yeah. I mean, Superman was like that. I mean, everyone's nostalgic about
Christopher Reeve. Well, we just want a really solid proof of concept.
Yeah, yeah,
and then
yeah.
other people can do it. Well, hell, then fucking Captain Marvel can come out good.
Yeah, right.
The more stuff we're getting from her, I'm getting excited about
that,
too.
Yeah, right. But anyway, I don't want to. I'm sorry, I took up so much time. Go ahead and talk about.
That's what you were gonna say. I don't want to take up too much time, and then your brain was like, "You totally already did."
Already
and you're
did.
Like, "I am sorry.
I am sorry.
I have to change that." Cause,
I'm sorry.
That's fine. Guess what I have right here?
Is that it? Is that
this is it?
Oh, wow!
This is
exciting.
A physical printout, of version 1.5. of my book, which I have... That's what I'm calling it.
Okay.
Still doesn't have a working title, although I've got one in my head. But it's, like, it's just something to fucking call it. I'm not sure it bears any resemblance to it. So it's, like, calling it, you know, Project something. I have now read it all the way through.
Okay. And you just let yourself read it without trying to do anything?
Yeah, I obvious typos I fixed.
Okay.
But not if there was actually one spot where I appear to have written the first half of a sentence and then just stopped and went on to. I actually left that because I'm like, there would be a lot of construction and stuff. I don't want to. But obvious typos I fixed. And yeah, that's basically it. It was just typos. And the big thing is because I realized there was going to be a functional use for this. I don't know that I'll keep them, but for now, I put in chapter numbers.
Mm.
Because the next thing, I did all this on my computer because why. Would I care? But now I have it physical because I'm going to take notes.
Oh,
I'm
yeah,
going to go through it and say, hey, you have to expand this, change this. And then maybe back here and stuff too. But so it's going to be easier if I'm taking notes on like the back of a sheet or whatever.
Yeah,
to be
yeah.
like chapter four. Because also once I start rewriting, mm-hmm. something like at this word count or this page number will do me no good. So, yeah, so I thought that'll... be helpful, but yeah, so next I'm going to read through it again and take all my notes, and then I'm going to write it over again.
Rewrite, yeah. So how did you feel when you read it through?
Well, I talked about it a little bit last time, and some of it's still true. There's a lot of good in there. I'm pretty pleased, and again, like, there's more humor in it than I remember writing in it, but I feel like it works. It's not goofy, per se. It's also terrible. It makes no sense, is what it is. There are plot holes. There are contradictions all over the place. Mm. And it's just because in my head the story was changing as I was writing. Mm-hmm. And so now I'll go back and be like, oh, I referenced the thing that I thought I had mentioned before, and I clearly didn't. Somebody's like, they use this particular prop. And I'm like, I never even said they had that. And that's specific. And I'm like, they do have it, but I clearly forgot to ever write that.
Yeah, yeah.
And a couple times when I'm trying to do, like, mythology building and stuff, people will specify, like, let's say, a rule about something. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I literally 10 chapters ago laid down a rule that was the exact opposite. Apparently I forgot that part. So there's a lot of that shit going on. And a few of the, you know, if he just had flown the Eagles all the way to Mount Doom kind of things.
Right.
And so I need to deal with these.
Oh, I hate when I run into that kind of stuff, because that's like, I got to rewrite this whole stupid
usually
thing.
Usually I can get around it. Okay. And like, and there's some that I put in there intentionally so that my characters can call them out. And those
sure,
are kind of
sure,
fun.
Sure, sure, sure.
And not just in a like silly look at the camera. Like usually like, that would normally be true. Here's this weird circumstance.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're acknowledging the fact that it is a weird circumstance.
Right, right.
So yeah, I'm getting kind of excited to see what happens. Not in the story. I know what happens in the story. But, although there are a couple of things. I've got a thing that I would say is on par with, in your first novel, you told me the original draft had none of the Sharon stuff in it.
Yeah, hardly any of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I have a thing that I would say is on scale of the Sharon stuff that I'm thinking about adding.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, it's going to just completely change the whole fucking book.
Mm-hmm.
But it's right on. I'm like, it's either going to be cool and add new dimensions to all this, or it's going to be really clunky and stupid and make
yep,
it much
yep,
worse.
Yep, that's like, what you think before you do it.
Yeah. And every day I go back, like every day I'm like, oh no, it's perfect. It has to go. And the next day I'm like, that is stupid. You should leave that out entirely.
Yeah. I mean, you might.
And I do have to remind myself afterwards, a bunch of other people are going to look at it. And if it's really stupid, they'll hopefully say something. So I think I'm going to err on the side of write it. But
yeah, that's what you should do.
But there's still
do.
scope issues.
This is really exciting. I mean,
yeah, I'm pretty excited.
I can't wait to read a draft.
We've been watching new TV because we got CISO.
I don't know what that is.
CISO is, I think NBC did it. It's basically a streaming channel. It's like, think of it as almost like a little mini Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
It's their own streaming service, but the content is largely exclusive to there. Mm. And this one in particular is comedy focused.
Mm.
So, like, there's a bunch of comedy specials on there that you don't see other places, that there's performances from the UCB on there and stuff like that. We haven't played around too much, but one thing we've discovered, that there's a reason I want to talk about it, this is really awesome, is a TV show, original to CISO, called Take My Wife.
Okay.
Have you not heard about this?
Nope.
Oh, I thought you might have. So, how do I put this? There is a real life... Everything I'm about to tell you is not the plot of a TV show. This is just real life.
Okay.
There is a stand-up comic. Her name is Cameron Esposito.
I've heard of her.
She's kind of becoming a thing right now. You can recognize her really easy because she has a weird sort of sideways mullet.
Okay.
Like, she has this one chunk of hair on one side that's really long.
Okay.
And she is openly lesbian comic... comedian, okay. Been doing this for like 15 years. She had a girlfriend, now a wife,
okay,
named Rhea Butcher,
okay,
who is also a comedian,
right,
but is way early, like, she's been a comedian for a couple of years,
okay.
And so she is still relatively unknown as a comedian. Or had been until recently.
Okay.
And weird as it sort of is, a lot of the attention she's been able to get is through her connection to Cameron.
Okay.
So people say, oh, your girlfriend wants to perform? Okay, do that.
Mm.
But anyway, yeah, so they're in a relationship, and then they got married, and here they are. And I believe Cameron Esposito has a regular comedy show at a particular club in LA, like once a month. A lot of comics have these kind of things, but she hosts one.
Does she do something for Amy Poehler's Smart Girls?
It's quite possible. It's quite possible.
I think that
that would make sense to me. I believe it is also true that her wife now co-hosts it with her
on the Smart Girls thing.
No, this is a thing called Best Bet, I think. That's just a non-televised thing in a club in
LA.
Well,
in the Smart Girls thing, it's two women.
I don't know what Smart Girls is, so...
Amy Poehler has this thing called Smart Girls it's supposed to... It has its content for girls to, I don't know, give advice, build self-esteem, and...
Okay.
It's a feminist kind of pro-girl thing. And there were this series of... shows with a female, I'm pretty sure she was a comedian, and she was gay. I mean, that wasn't kind of a thing, but she revealed that as the show went on. And her partner was there with her.
Okay.
Helping her with it. So I don't know, maybe it's different people, but
I do not know.
Her hairstyle looks like that.
I would be absolutely unsurprised if it was.
Okay,
it would make a lot of sense if it was, but I have absolutely no idea. But anyway, so they're co-hosting. I believe originally Cameron Esposito used to host the show herself and then got her wife involved, and they co-hosted. Anyway, they decided to do a TV show. And the TV show is basically about what I just described to you.
Oh.
The opening scene of the first episode is one of them carrying the other across the threshold on their wedding night.
Mm.
And then it cuts back to a year earlier. And they're just dating, but they live together, and Cameron's working as a comic full-time, and Rhea's doing other work at the same time, but trying to do it. And it just sort of starts from there, and it's just sort of their life. But it appears that it is quite largely autobiographical. it is co-written by them and everything. The it's very lo-fi, like it's very... There's some hipstery aspect. It reminds me of other versions like Marin or Garfunkel and Oates. If it was going to be on a real network, it would be IFC.
Okay.
A little bit Portlandia, but not as smug, you know, that kind of thing. but it's very sort of lo-fi, and it's very sort of weird and quirky. So the first episode, I was like, I'm not sure if I like... I definitely want to see more, but I'm not sure what I'm watching.
Right.
But I think either it got better, or just knowing what to expect, the second episode was way better. It's very funny, and it's just very... real and very self-referential in places. They have a scene of the two of them lying in bed talking after having had sex, and they partially talk about how on TV you never see that, basically, and stuff like this. There was a really kind of chilling bit. There was an episode that took largely place during the show, and one of the male comics was doing a joke. He's saying, in society today, basically, the only way anyone will believe a woman has been raped is if 48 other women show up and claim that the same individual also raped them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's like, that's why I always keep my raping to just 47 women, and then I can't get caught. And people laughed or whatever, and backstage they're talking about, why is it the only people talking about rape are male comics? Because you always hear it from them. You don't hear it from anybody else anywhere. But anyway, so he's doing that. And he's, in general, he's actually a comic I like, but he's playing kind of an asshole in this thing. Yeah. But afterwards, there's a scene with him and them talking out front. Because Rhea's character, possibly Rhea herself, the Rhea Butcher on the show, goes into the bathroom after that joke and is kind of freaking out a little bit, and then talks later about how she was sort of reliving past trauma that triggered.
Triggered, yeah.
And so outside later, the three of them are talking after the show outside, one of them's having a cigarette or something, and he's like, by the way, Rhea, sorry, I didn't know you were a survivor. I would have warned you or something like that. And she's like, no, it's fine. And then Cameron says, so am I. And then there's a woman over standing by the club, and she's like, so am I. And then it cuts to just about... every woman you've seen in the episode so far turns to the camera and says, so am I.
Mm.
And then he just comes back and the whole thing's just silent for a minute, and then it goes on. And I was like, that was kind of awesome.
Yeah.
That was pretty impressive. But it's also, I mean, it's also silly as hell. As the series is going, it's only 6 half-hour episodes. But it's getting sort of more surreal in ways. But I really, it feels very genuine, and I like it.
Mm.
And it's making me discover that Rhea Butcher is hilarious. I heard her in an interview one time on a podcast talking about video games. She seemed fine, but she didn't seem super, like, funny.
Yeah.
No, she's funny as hell.
Okay.
So, and it's also making me like Cameron Esposito more. Oh, man, I gotta hurry. All right, so, saw two movies worth talking about on the same day, back to back. We went and saw Secret Life of Pets.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good. It's funny. I'm not sorry I saw it. It, whatever. It's an also-ran. Like, it was fine. It was fun. It's probably about as good as Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Maybe not quite as good as that, but there, up there. It's good. But if you have kids and you need to take them to a movie, this is a good one to do it to.
Because
you will also laugh and you will not fall asleep or cry. But, you know, whatever. And then right after that, and I'm glad we saw it in this order, we saw Kubo and the Two Strings. Kubo and the Two Strings is very good.
Mm-hmm.
The primary reason it is very good, it is some fucking gorgeous stop-motion animation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's real stop-motion animation. It's not made to look like stop-motion animation, even though it looks like it might be made to look like... Here's the thing. I think they rotoscoped it afterward.
Mm.
So it looks animated mm-hmm. to a degree. Mm-hmm. But all the motion looks... stop motion, and there's a mid-credits sequence where you actually see them setting up and filming, like, in fast motion, one of the scenes from it. So I'm confident it's real stop motion.
Mm.
And it's just gorgeous, but on top of that, it's a really decent story. It's not a mind-blowing story, it's not a breaking a lot of boundaries story. I'm pretty sure Jazz will explain why that's not true in the blog later. And I will defer to her on this, because actually her knowledge of story structure history is probably way better than mine. But it's a good story. I don't know if it's based off of a real folktale, but it's a Japanese folktale that they might have just pulled out of their butts. Mm. But it feels very authentic in that sense. And yeah, I very much recommend it. It is a little scary for kids. We saw it with the neighbors, including the neighbor children, who are 6 and 8. Okay. The 8-year-old was fine, loved it. The 6-year-old, who tends to be sensitive about this stuff, reminds me of me when I was 6, near the end was concerned less about it being scary, although it kind of was, than it was loud during the end, and sort of sat on Trish's lap and plugged his ears for a great... And the end, I mean, there's some dark stuff that happens in it, but I mean, I'd say it's definitely less scary than Zootopia for kids.
You thought Zootopia was scary?
Kids did.
Really?
Yeah, there's some shit where, like, panther men come out of the shadows and try and eat people and shit. Oh, like, yeah. There were angry predator animals in dark and stormy places. Like, that. This is probably on par with that in terms of scary. I mean, they've got villainesses who just have, like, pointy black hats and, like, a faceless mask, and they sort of float around and hardly move and then talk at you, but their face doesn't move because it's the mask. That's kind of creepy. It's stuff I thought was creepy, so little kids might think it's scary. But like I said, 8-year-old, no problem. Mm-hmm. And 6-year-old still liked it overall. Okay. Is glad he saw it. So I think it's largely pretty okay for kids. I believe it is PG, for those who worry about that kind of stuff. So yeah, I recommend that one very much. And I feel like it's one that's really worth it on the big screen, because it's a big screen to see the visuals. I will say this, tiny side area spoiler. George Takei is in this film. Mm-hmm. You'll note I don't say George Takei stars in this film. There is he plays a townsperson. He says a couple of scene setting lines, like along with other townspeople at one point. Mm-hmm. And then there's a point where he sees something shocking and says, "Oh my." That's it. I'm like, really? I love George Takei, but I feel like he can't come cheap. I'm not sure the "oh my" joke was worth what he must charge. But for George Takei fans like myself, that's in there, so enjoy that. Yeah, I was a little surprised. And at first I was like, is somebody impersonating him? But in the end credits, he comes up fairly early and gets his own screen. And I'm like, he had like 30 seconds. All right, so Hat, where is the Hat? That's a problem.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
That's underwear.
That's... Almost
those are my gym clothes for tomorrow.
That's almost the opposite of the hat.
Oh, no, they're magical and they talk. Oh, wait, the hat doesn't talk. Where is the hat? This could be a problem.
We lost.
Oh, my God. So much for anything else that was in this episode. This is just going to be the episode where we lost the fucking hat.
Well, I mean, it won't be the... If we don't manage to find it, it won't be the first time we didn't answer any questions on
it. It'll be the second time, but it'll be the first time we did it through our own stupidity. Mm. Wow, this is amazing. This is amazing.
I mean, I often don't see it when I come in because it's, like, over there.
But, yeah, but I always know.
And I don't...
Is it behind?
I can't see where it is.
It's not behind there.
From here, behind your
I
back,
can
like
turn
a magic
this
trick.
Light on. That would help. Is it under that? Check under your chair. It's sneaky like that.
No.
How is this possible? Oh my God.
Yeah, that's a good question.
This is gonna freak the hell out of everyone.
Wow. Yeah, how is that possible? I
mean, maybe it's a magical hat of walking around.
Yeah, someone would have actually had to pick it up and take it. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's a fairly... It's a hat, for God's sake. So you can't really miss it.
Yeah. It's definitely a hat. I hope I'm still... Yeah.
Unless someone put it on their head. That would be a huge mistake.
I always just assumed, like, they would get sucked up inside of it. Well, and spill out all the note cards also. But
you just don't know what that
This is amazing.
What are you gonna do? Dude, I have no, I mean, I don't see.
No, and it should stand out.
Yeah. I mean, it's never.
What's, I see something of the same color over there. Next to the vinegar.
Over here?
Yeah. See that pile of mail?
Yeah.
I see something of the right color, but... Mm-hmm. What about over there by the floral bag?
Yeah, I looked right there. Dude.
Hey, baby?
Seriously.
A little help?
Unbelievable. You think... You think Trish knows where it is?
I don't know. I just figure another set of eyes. This is ridiculous. We're still recording. we can't find the hat.
Like, you lost it.
Okay.
Sit back down in your seat.
Ah!
There it is.
Oh! You're awesome. Why is everybody yelling?
I'm guessing because there's a cat outside.
William, can you scare off that cat?
Well, there is a cat, a black cat.
Open the door and hiss. Don't let the cats out. Be careful with that. There we go. And William's gone. Thanks, baby.
Why do they care about there being cats?
I don't know. It's a thing cats do. I think it's some sort of territorial thing, I think. Sort of why they have trouble when a new cat shows up. At first they're like, fuck you, this is our place. And then they have to figure out that they're stuck with them. Here's the hat, William. If you want to draw something out of there.
If I'd looked more careful over there, I'd probably see.
It was kind of sneaking out. Well, and other than the fact that it almost disappears, it's kind of a convenient spot for it. But that's too funny.
Well, this question seems to only apply to me because you know this person.
All right. Well, William's not able to answer, so.
Coffee asks.
Coffee.
If you were going to become a close friend with me, please share what would be important for me to know. Well, I suppose you could...
It's arguable that we're not close friends, but we're totally close friends.
Could be closer friends, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, is there something that you could share with her that would make her a closer friend?
I don't know. Well, you answer while I'm thinking about this, because this one's tricky for me. But, I mean, you can use what you know of her, or you could just, in general, if you wanted to become close friends with somebody... What do you think would be something important that they would need to know that not necessarily the average person would know? Like that an acquaintance wouldn't know.
If you were going to become a close friend, be important, yeah. I never really thought about there being anything a person needed to know in order to be a close friend of mine.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I don't...
No annoying habits they might need to be warned about, or...
Warned?
Yeah, if it's something that is off-putting to the degree that, without a little preparation, they might be like, oh my god, I don't want to be near him.
Oh.
Like, I mean, it could be as simple as...
It's not guaranteed we're going to be close friends?
Yeah. Before we become close friends, you need to know,
In case this matters to you?
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh.
And so, if you're picking, it's something either that you think should matter to them in some form or another, or something that, in your experience, people tend to care about, you know?
Hmm.
So, in your case, one could argue that the I've never had any alcohol and don't intend to thing could be something.
Well, you know, it often is a thing.
But it's a weird example here because it's not something you save to tell a close friend. Like, you just tell people.
I mean,
not an introduction, but...
Weirdly, people there are some things I've found that people get upset with me if they don't know it right up front.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that's about, but you're right. I don't think those really count.
It's tricky for me because I do tell everybody everything. So, and especially, I'm pretty sure anything that would fall in this category for me is stuff that has already been said on the podcast.
Well, and there are a lot of things I don't talk about, but they're always very intimate, private things, you know, like that most people aren't going to worry about you not talking to them.
That's
about
the thing, though. But it's not something that I would only speak with a close friend about. It's just, you know, before. So, things for me, being bisexual is definitely one. Used to be being pagan was one, now being atheist is one. My whole gender deal is definitely one. To become close friends, I think, because it's a lot of stuff that's very intrinsic to who I am and how I live. My feminism, certain aspects of my feminism, because there are controversial feminist issues out there, and they're sort of like, you know, I want you to know where I fall on that kind of stuff beforehand. Yeah, I don't know. It's never something I consciously think about. And I frequently tell people all sorts of personal stuff long before we're at a close friend level. So I don't know how well it works for me. I do feel that Coffee and I are already close friends. So I don't know, Coffee. What did I tell you?
Well, here's one thing.
I actually don't answer that. I know all the stuff I told Coffee. Coffee got subjected to a lot of my oversharing really early on.
Here's one thing that comes to mind. I don't know. This is the answer, but it's something that's popping up in my head, is I'm not good at commiserating.
Ooh.
I'm not good at...
Oh.
If what you're look... If what you consider close friendship is the two of you can sit down and basically just stew in complaining about something or hating something or having a nice feedback loop in negativity, I'm not good at that.
Now, I feel like that is probably a good one to cover.
Now, that doesn't mean that if you're complaining about something or struggling with something, I'm going to look at you and say, ah, buck up,
no, camper.
Or any of that nonsense.
Well, and I know that's true because I have come to you with horrible stuff and you've been like, oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
But I haven't hung around with you and like spent a couple hours chewing the fat about my horrible stuff.
So I won't belittle what you're thinking or feeling. I mean, I'll empathize and I will sit there with you to show my moral support. But if you think it's going to be therapeutic to have someone to... commiserate is the only word I can come up with.
I think it's appropriate.
I'm not good at that.
Yeah.
I can be with you in that moment, and I can empathize, and I can feel bad for your situation. But I know there are some people who find it therapeutic just to really complain and maybe even get mean about it with somebody, especially over a beer or something, and I can't.
I
don't really do that.
I am also not usually good at that. The exceptions tend to be if I genuinely feel that way. Mm-hmm. If somebody comes to me and I say, I got screwed over by this person, and I'm like, I know that person, and I know the situation, and you did fucking get screwed over by the person, then I can commiserate just fine. But in general, like, if somebody's like, you know, I got fired from my job, and they want to shit all over the company, I'm like, I'll do what I can, but I also am always aware, you know, like, I didn't know the situation, maybe you need to. Mm-hmm. But I think I still commiserate well because I tend to be good at redirecting to the things you can work on or to the empathic statements and say, yeah, your boss sucks. I'm like, man, I got fired once and it is rough.
Yeah, and you feel
really weird, you know, just sort of deflecting to that kind of stuff. But I'm not always good at it. Sometimes I make little suggestions. Maybe it's not entirely. And then they are not happy with me. And Trish has had to teach me. I have what sadly is a fairly common guy thing. When she's telling me problems, she mostly just wants to cathart, essentially.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, I'm trying to come up with solutions.
I'm not one of those people that does that, really.
I do that, and I used to do a lot worse. I'm much better now.
Oh, well, I used to do it quite a bit because I just didn't understand.
Yeah,
like I just thought that the person was looking for a solution. Then I realized, oh, wait, no, that's not the case. So I've kind of gotten over that.
Yeah, that's true. I have, is when somebody and this happens way more often than I would expect, somebody comes to me with outrage, and they issue a statement. And I attempt to commiserate and share in this, and find out that I guessed wrong about which part of this they were outraged about. And then it's weird. Well, I get that. Like, can you believe that this person made this thing? And I'm like, holy crap, that person? You're so much better. And they're like, no, I mean, why would we be working on this thing? I'm like, oh, shit, sorry.
Well, related to not being able to commiserate is I don't generally take sides on things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing. It kind of related to the commiserating thing. Some people, when they come to you and they want to talk to you, they want you to pick a side.
Yeah.
Their side, but their side could be a specific side.
Yeah.
I'm not very good at doing that.
I am not internally, but I can do it for people. It frequently depends on the consequences. You know, if somebody wants to rip on their boss, and their boss is not somebody I'm ever going to deal with, and what and I know it's really bad on them, you know what? I can shit on a guy I've never met that causes them stress. You know, now if they say let's go egg their house, I'm like, but I can't. It depends, but yeah, it depends on the consequences. If it's something that's happening at my job with a coworker, well, then I probably know more about it, and I know there are two sides to every story, and da 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 da. But
and finally, related to this too, if someone's going to come to me with their problems, if I don't understand what they're saying, I almost can't help myself but to ask. I mean, there's sometimes where I just think, okay, this person's just venting, and they're not trying to make sense or anything. Just keep your mouth shut and let them go. But there are sometimes where I just have to ask questions, like I feel like it's not right for me. Like, if later they talk to me about this and say, remember when we talked about this, I'm not even going to remember any of it because I didn't understand it.
I'll do that in cases when I genuinely have no idea. Somebody recently told me about a thing that they watched during one of the national conventions. And I'm not going to go into details here, but it was a thing that, like, that particular thing made news stories. And they talked about how they were so upset, I think, that they cried over it. And I was like, and I was like, okay, did you cry because of this person that was involved, or did you cry in sympathy for that person because of these people? Because I genuinely didn't know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it depends on what it is. A big factor also is who was on the other side. If it's some people that I can be like, you know, you might be full of shit there. And they're like, oh, God, I know that. And if it's other people, it's like, have you considered the other side? And I know they're going to freaking slit their wrists. Then I won't say that.
And that's the point of me bringing it up, because a lot of times the questions I ask, you know, even if I'm not trying, I'm trying to suggest anything by the question I'm asking. I'm not criticizing them. I'm asking a legitimate question, but it very often can cause them to be introspective in a way that makes them think that they might be having a little lack of perspective, or maybe they're being silly, and because they feel that way, they think I'm trying to make them feel that way by the question I'm asking, when I'm not. I'm just asking
the
question.
And that's why I've never liked you. We are super over time, so I think the takeaway here is,
don't be friends with William. That's the
takeaway. Don't be friends with William, and if you're gonna be good friends with Tony, you have to accept the fact that he's going to bug you about writing on the blog, themagicaltalkinghead.com. He's going to bug you about liking the hat on Facebook. And he's going to eat a lot, and I mean a lot, of fried chicken. Like, just almost nonstop.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.